While the episode doesn't reach the vertiginous heights of the series' best, it says something about Curb's enduring brilliance that even a relatively unremarkable installment such as this is still funnier than almost anything currently on television. That's Dan Ein of Financial Times talking about Curb Your Enthusiasm Season 12, which is now in the books. And as Chris Cody just said to me, he has not seen it as of yet. We're recording this on Monday. We're about to have a solar eclipse. May all die. So spoiler free, I promise I will not tell you what happens in the waning moments of the episode. Maybe we'll give it a week or two and then we can hopefully people by then have an idea of it. But I totally get it. I myself wasn't sure if I was going to be able to watch it last night live on Max. I wasn't sure how it worked. I was like, I know it's live on HBO, obviously. For years I had HBO. Then I canceled it, for those who are unaware, using my sister-in-law's Max account. I wasn't sure if after the episode airs, then it's on Max. But it's right away, like 10:01, it popped up on Max. I'm like, fantastic. So I was spoiler-free, and thankfully nobody texted me saying, hey, what'd you think of that episode, or how about this thing? Like, that has happened in the past. I believe Better Call Saul, a couple people may have attempted to ruin it for me, but probably just hurled the phone across the room. But spoiler-free, we will discuss Curb Your Enthusiasm as it wraps up one of the great shows. Our old movie this week is Crumb. It's my favorite documentary of all time. We were talking a lot last week about Steven Spielberg's favorite movie, Ikiru, the Akira Kurosawa film, which I did in tribute to my friend Glennie Mack. So I thought to myself, well, I want to do some of my favorites. So my favorite documentary of all time, Crumb. It's absolutely brilliant, from 1995, Terry Zwigoff. It's a work of genius, all but R. Crumb, the cartoonist. And our wild card, he's a beauty, man. Keith Olbermann, the one and only, my favorite broadcaster, locked and loaded on topics all over the place. We talked a little Curb Enthusiasm, talked about his relationship with his late dear friend, Richard Lewis, who was on the finale and was obviously always brilliant in the final show. But also KO's love of the film Network. That's his favorite movie. He's got a great Lauren Bacall story for all you old Hollywood fans. So KO and some Sage Steele material as well. For all the ESPN listeners, we got a little Sage Steele talk out of the gate, a little Norby talk. So we definitely went inside baseball, but he's the best and someone I deeply respect and admire. So I greatly appreciate KO making some time with us. And of course, his podcast is called Countdown with Keith Olbermann. You should all listen to it Tuesdays, Wednesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays. It's on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. It's also available on YouTube, and his numbers are growing, as one might expect. Let's dive in, though. I forgot to mention, though, last week, you always give me these blurbs, which are fantastic. I forgot to get a couple of those blurbs. It haunted me all week. I was going to call you after, go, I got to get these blurbs in. Not the ones about Godzilla X Kong, but about Ikiru, because these are fantastic. Tiber of Boston Globe. There has never been a smarter, more capacitive film about imminent death. And Roger Ebert of Chicago Sun-Times, I think this is one of the few movies that might actually be able to inspire someone to lead their life a little differently. I mean, that's brilliant stuff from Roger Ebert, Chicago Sun-Times.
I'll finally be able to sleep now that you read those.
I finally got my Akira blurbs out. Chris's hard work was finally put to the test. Do you ever pay attention to that kind of stuff? Like, if you feed Dan or Stu material and they don't use it, like, do you notice that or you don't really care?
Oh, like, the peak of that is for years and years. Now I have someone else helping me with it, but I was doing all of the interview research for every guest, like a full sheet with all their bio info and questions he can ask. And maybe like once every seven guests, Dan would use like one of the questions. Like, yeah, it was really all like for naught. Like, obviously, as a producer, you have to do that work just in case Dan needs it. But the amount of times where I would spend hours on interview prep and he would not use a single thing from it. Like, that's just part, that's them's of the breaks. Like, that's part of the job, but that was always a little frustrating.
Yeah, I get it. Sometimes in the moment, right, he's going in a different direction and you want him to zig, he wants to zag, fine, I get it. But I'm with you. If it's something that I really feel passionately about and I really think this will be something of interest, got to get it in. Like, I mean, we have these incredible researchers at MLB Network. The other day we had Seth Warner, who does an unbelievable job. We were talking about your Marlins off to a miserable start. And then Steve Phillips went in a different direction. It wasn't his fault. I think I kind of got him on the Tigers. He started going, but I still had to get the nugget in. So like, I waited till Steve finished all his stuff with the Tigers. My other, by the way, Marlins minus 30 run differential. That's the worst right now in baseball. And after Seth was joking, he's like, we'd already gone to the next topic. I said, no, but you gave me that information. You gave me that nugget. I want to get it in there. I want to make sure that you know your work is being used. He's like, because when I'm feeding you stuff, I'm like, I want to make sure it's being used. Otherwise, you start to lose the guy, right? If you're feeding me stuff and I don't use it, well, I guess I'm not interested.
At some point, I start doing a little less work on the interview research if I know that he's never going to use it.
Yeah, exactly right.
But there is nothing better than like him going to one of your questions, like first question, and then it gets the interview off and you're like, this was me.
Especially after you worked together a while, you're simpatico. Like at this point, if you were to do interview research for me, you would already know what to, like, would, in the course of doing research, we go, oh, I name him like that. He'll like this. Yeah. He'll be like, he won't care about that. Like, if you know each other well enough, I'm like, this is like a cheat code. Like, this is much easier having you do the research for me.
And you are great, because anytime I throw a question in the chat during an interview, you always ask it.
I'm on it. Yeah. Come on. I'm always receptive to ideas. I want this to be as collaborative as possible. Speaking of collaborative, it's always nice when people, you know, tweet or IG, let me know if they actually, you know, what they liked in the pod, didn't. I was hoping for a couple people saying that they actually watched Akira after my tribute last week. Gentleman Frank, who's a huge Kurosawa fan, I knew he would tweet me because he loves Akira as much as I do. But there's been more than a few people saying, hey, I really enjoyed Win-Win, the Giamatti movie that I recommend. It's on Hulu. People are like, yeah, I never heard of that movie before. I really enjoyed it. So you make my day when you let me know you're actually watching these movies and actually paying attention to what I'm saying and going looking it up and wherever streaming service it may be. All right, let's talk Curb because we went long with KO, but he was great. So I want to do a little bit of Curb, but I don't want to spoil anything. This last season, but I got to be honest, as I told you, I didn't have it right away, HBO, so I caught up. The first couple, I'm like, woof. I was like, eh. And you and I are in agreement that, you know, the series isn't as strong as it once was, which I don't even know how that's necessarily a criticism. After 12 seasons in 23 years, I would be shocked if Larry David still had his fastball.
This season.
But there's a few episodes that are absolutely brilliant. I thought the one about, I mean, Vince Vaughn really came on strong this season, proved himself as a funkhouser.
The Disney episode?
That I think might be my favorite of the season. When he finds out that his girlfriend is working at Disney or working for Disney, and then all of a sudden it comes out that she works at the Disney store. And when she starts breaking all those different characters, I'm crying. And that whole stuff with Larry and Tracy Ullman trying to get out of their relationship and using what he can. Richard Lewis, the late Richard Lewis, brilliant as always. His best bit, I thought, was when he was at the AA meeting and he's basically there like doing his act. And yeah. He's just going there to get like laughs and stuff. And Larry's like, you're just doing an act. He's like, yeah. And then people are walking out going like, oh my God, that was so funny. He's like, thanks. He's like, next Tuesday, I'll be here again. New material. Like,
yeah.
This is unbelievable. You're using this as a racket for your stuff. I thought Troy Kotsur was good. Of course, he's the deaf actor from Coda. Gets hit with the golf by Larry. It was good. What I'm always amused by is when they realize which guys should actually play themselves and who should play characters. Meaning, sometimes you have Conan O'Brien playing Conan O'Brien, and Larry's violating the clearance locks. He didn't have clearance to go talk to him. And by the way, Conan and Larry are friends in real life. There's somebody who apparently did violate that clearance law, which is where that joke came from. But then you have Steve Buscemi playing a character. So like, and I was always curious how they make that decision. Larry goes, sometimes we just think, oh, is it funny to have Steve Buscemi or is it better to have him as a character? And this instance, him smelling a car that has terrible BO was better that way. Similarly, the last episode, I won't go into details, but Greg Kinnear, who I love, shows up playing a lawyer. So for those who have been following the season, Larry's on trial, could be going to jail.
Yeah.
The opposing counsel is Greg Kinnear. I'm like, oh my God, I love Greg Kinnear. But it's not Greg Kinnear, it's Greg Kinnear playing a Southern lawyer. So I always found it amazing. And by the way, the judge for Breaking Bad fans is Dean Norris. That's Hank, who is Bryan Cranston's brother-in-law on the show. So I'm like, I find it amazing the kind of pull he's got. And of course, I haven't even seen The Big Fish yet. Bruce Springsteen was on the penultimate episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm and was in the finale. So LD for his final season, pulling at all the stops. He's like, you know what, man, I'm gonna use my guys. I'm going to go ahead and get Bruce Springsteen. And Bruce was funny. I mean, Susie Essman, of course, is amazing. As Jeff Garland's wife said, you know, certain people come on who you think are going to be really funny and they're okay. And then some surprise you because Bruce surprises. Because again, for those that don't know, this is what to me is always the most amazing part of the show. It's all ad-libbed. And I'm like, How could you possibly do that? Like,
there's premises. It's just
right,
like
the premises there.
Yeah.
Right. The outline is Chris goes into a store, buys the fish, tries to return the fish. But like all the dialogue, they're just going. I can't remember when I met Super Dave, who was amazing. I met him years ago in Toronto. He came on a morning show I was doing. And I said, you had the funniest line ever when Larry said he was peeing sitting down. And his response was Marty Funkhouser was the character's name. He says, what are you, crap standing up? And I said, and Bob Einstein, of course, is brilliant. And I said, you know, did you just ad-lib that line? He's like, of course I did. I go, that is like such a funny line, intrinsically funny. I'm like, I just, it's amazing how they were able to get so much mileage out of that. But you have to have these actors that can do that, that have that facility with ad-libbing. Obviously, Jeff Garland's brilliant. We've had Jeff, by the way, on the pod. Maybe I'll have Jeff Garland next week. We'll replay his episode. Years ago, I had him on when I was at ESPN. He was awesome. He talked about that specific part of being on Curb, being able to ad-lib and find areas that are funny and get guys to laugh. And what I always found was great was, you know, the moments when Larry was actually laughing. Like there's one where clip people were surfacing after Richard Lewis passed away, when a mime talks to them, but like not a mime in mime garb, like just a regular businessman. He goes to Richard Lewis, he's like, mouthing the words. And the way Lewis says, like, what the F was that? He goes, the way Larry laughs, like, you know, that was like a genuine laugh. Like he's breaking character there because Lewis genuinely made him laugh. And their relationship is so great because they're the best of friends, but also enemies. But, you know, Larry's always said, he goes, I'm not that guy. It's a heightened version of me. Like I'm not going around being all cranky and, you know, furious with people all day. I think of these things and I would like to say these things and the character allows me to do that. So it's almost a great part of being an actor is it allows him to be cathartic because I think it's one of the reasons why the show never wins. Like I'd love to see Curb Your Enthusiasm. They never win the Best Comedy Series Emmy. He's never won Best Actor. I think everyone thinks, well, he's just playing himself. And it's, yet when you hear people who are close to him, like, well, it's an extension of him. He's not that much of a jerk. Like, he's not, like, what do you think he is?
You think they'll win some on the way out here?
Well, that's what I'm wondering. Like, 12th season, you know, there's certain ways that you always wrap up a show. You want them to be rewarded. Obviously, Succession was going to be a heavyweight. You know, they were going to do well. But, like, Better Call Saul never won an Emmy. Even in their final season, they'd get nominated, but they went, like, 0 for 56 or 0 for 63, whatever it is.
That's crazy.
Nuts. Like, Better Call Saul is one of the best dramas in the last 20 years. It never won a single Emmy Award. Ray Seahorn only got nominated twice at the end. Odenkirk never won. So I'd love to tell you they're going to win, but I don't know. I'd have to look at whether he's going to get nominated. I'm sure it'll be, you know, one of these limited series type things that gets made. But now, I mean, listen, the door's open a little bit because some of those shows have moved on. Like, there's no more Ted Lasso. There's no more Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. Those shows always do well when it comes to the Emmys. So I would love to see Curb get rewarded. But again, spoiler free of the finale, I will just say that it felt in line with some of my predictions. Somebody had tweeted me, what did you think? And I said, well, he's going to be on trial. So I would imagine there's going to be a scene where he's in jail, and I'll leave it at that. And I was very happy to see a very famous person close to Larry David show up. I was pretty certain Jerry Seinfeld was going to come at some point. So it was good to see Jerry show up. Obviously he's one of his good friends, and obviously he's a huge name, and you think of their bond with Seinfeld. So above all, I thought in some ways it kind of followed the Seinfeld playbook in terms of, because a final episode's tricky. You don't want to do like a greatest hits, but it kind of do, because it gets the last episode. So you do almost kind of want to replay, go, hey, remember that time when, which reminds me of Michael Lombardi, one of our favorite lines from The Sopranos, when Tony's getting so pissed off with Paulie. He goes, you know, remember when is the lowest form of conversation. But you think about that every time I'm with somebody and they're being nostalgic, like, you know, like a college buddy or something, like, hey, remember that time? I'm like, remember when is the lowest form of conversation. Like, it's like saying, you know, how about this weather we've been having? How about the solar eclipse? I'm like, you have nothing else, but you're reaching back to 20 years ago.
Yeah.
But I think in a final episode, you kind of want to do that. And Seinfeld was very heavily criticized. I don't know anybody who likes the finale. Everyone loves the show, as they should, but everyone agrees the finale is bad. I did see Larry David in an interview recently. Someone said, do you feel like you need to make amends for the Seinfeld finale? And he said, without missing a beat, like I care. And I'm like, yeah, there's definitely no way Larry David stays up on it. Like, God, I wish we should do a better Seinfeld finale. Like, I think he just hit his
I bet he cares about
a little
that.
Bit. Okay, because he seemed very flippant in his remark, like I care. I'm like, he did get kind of crushed on that one. Like, everyone knows how great Seinfeld is, but you did not stick the landing.
I think he would have chosen to have it be received well. Like, the fact that he's just like, don't care.
Yeah, no, that's probably true. You're right. If you have a choice of being crushed for two decades after it, or everyone saying how great was that Seinfeld finale, he probably would have taken the former. But ultimately, I thought it was a satisfying conclusion, and I'm just impressed by the longevity of it. Again, 23 years to do a show. To do over 12 seasons. And the fact that, I mean, Jim Miller, who of course wrote the book about HBO, he said that, you know, Larry just had that relationship with HBO. Like, I want to do another season, or I don't want to do another season, or I'll wait 5 years for another season. Like, I can't think of many creative forces that could do that. I'm sure there's a handful of them out there, but think of how many people could just literally tell their boss, hey, I'm going to do a show and I'm going to take 2 years off, and then I might come back. I'm not really sure. We'll see how it goes. Like, maybe it wasn't very difficult financially. I can imagine, like, budget wise, I don't think it's a very expensive show. So it's basically carte blanche. Larry, if you want to do it, we'll have you back. I don't think he was asking for the moon. As Richard Lewis himself said, the guy's got more money than God. He's got dough all over the place. So he was not doing it for the money. Just if he had the creative impulses, he wanted to do it. And more often than not, Curb Your Enthusiasm was pretty good. Speaking of, Richard Lewis was a featured part of Curb Your Enthusiasm. He was a close friend of Keith Olbermann, KO, also stories on Larry David. Let's get to our special guest right now. KO.
Hi. Am I there?
You're great.
Yeah, there I am.
Squeeze you in before the eclipse.
Everybody I can see from my house is staring right into the sun already.
No funny glasses, nothing. Just to get after.
They're just sitting in Central Park looking up in the sky. Like, hurry up already. It's getting cloudy. Hurry up.
3:26. It'll hit.
Christ.
All right. Here we go.
You never seen darkness before.
Once in a lifetime.
Seriously.
Well, they say you should never meet your heroes, but they never met Keith Theodore Olbermann. I was not able to watch ESPN growing up in Canada, but once I started working at TSN, Canada's sports leader, I was able to watch the behind the scenes of he and Dan Patrick, known affectionately as The Big Show. I was hooked on KO, his wit, and of course his wisdom, and followed him there from Fox Sports, later MSNBC, Countdown with Keith Olbermann, which we'll get to his podcast in just a second, and then to current TV, and then to various iterations at ESPN. While with ESPN, I had the great fortune of being the fill in for KO 25 times, even once a career highlight being on the world's worst persons in the world as he falsely accused me of stealing his red pen. Mm-hmm. Through it all, he has been brilliant and he remains now my friend. And I cannot tell you how great his podcast is, which you should all listen to. And we will dive into things cinephile-esque with the one and only Keith Olbermann. KO, great to see you.
How did you wind up being the backup? I'm still trying to figure that one out.
So Dave Cerosi, our mutual friend, who we didn't know, I didn't know at the time.
Well, then he wasn't a mutual friend, was he? That's the whole point. Was all these mutual friend things turn out to be
right?
Just apparently, did you bribe somebody to do that, or were you being punished by somebody to do that? Either option strikes.
Apparently, you're sick, and Cerosi says to the room, so we can't just get anybody. Mm-hmm. But this is a list of people they've given us. I don't think it was Al Jaffe at that point, Lori Orlando, because like Johnny. Yeah. Like, can we get Johnny? No, you can't get Johnny Anderson. Okay. Well, of this list of backups, what do you like? And JB Kritz, your great researcher, says, listen, I know Adnan's a big Oberlin fan. He watches the show. He knows the show. He will be reverential, if anything. And then I remember Cerosi goes, well, I was in Canada at the time, and Jamie Horwitz reached out. And I said, oh my God, you don't understand. The chance to fill in for KO, please, the next time I will do it. And that day I filled in for you, one of the great days ever. No one's ever done this, I think, in ESPN history. Filled in for Bob Lee and Outside the Lines, hopped in the car service, filled in for you, wow. Midnight from Times Square. Pretty good day.
Wow. And look what happened to Bob and me. I mean,
you've been on a run lately on the podcast. We have to discuss some ESPN. This Sage Steel material is just fish in a barrel for you.
Went out the door.
The world's worst person in the world. I mean,
twice in three lists. It's not quite the record, but it's pretty close.
But like, I think about when you gave your convocation at Cornell and spoke about moral force, and she's speaking to college students and she just talks about herself. And she says
a slideshow of key moments in her career, including close-ups of her mouth after she got hit in a golf ball that she thought God put there. And then said, no, it must be the devil, not God.
So, right, the devil did it.
That's right. Both of the yin and the yang of the universe is intensely interested to the point of moving golf tournaments around just to affect what Sage Steele says or does not say. That's the starting point to be the worst person in the world. To really believe that one or possibly both halves of the universe are interested in what happens to you.
Well, and listen, you and I, we've made mistakes in the air. It happens, but we've never had this happen. She thinks that Joe Rogan, she thinks Dana White is Joe Rogan.
Yeah, just leans in and touches him, goes, so what's Joe Rogan's dream? And he just looks at her and she goes, so what's Dana White's dream? As if nobody noticed it the first time. And then the next story is her revealing that her interview with President Biden in 2021 was completely scripted, which she, for some reason, having played this tape and let this tape get out of her mistaking, you know, one bald like wrestling guy for another bald wrestling guy and just assuming that they completely scripted the Biden interview because Biden was the one who'd screw up the interview rather than her. I just read something, a Geraldo Rivera complaining about Larry David, how obnoxious that Larry David was to him in a person, the first time they met at an Alan Dershowitz party. Okay, so this thing is getting ratcheted up further and further upwards. And he's glad, Geraldo is glad that Larry David show is going off the air because he's a terrible person. He's really that person you see on TV. He's really that person. And it's like, yeah, but he's also he leaves out the good parts. We're all that person. That's the point of the show. And Geraldo, there's no awareness, even for a second, that people might think Geraldo Rivera is a jerk because maybe Geraldo Rivera is a jerk. And the same thing with Sage Steele. Like, did you ever think that all the times we would script your little 30-second interviews during SportsCenter when she and I anchored together maybe half a dozen times, all her stuff was scripted because they all were terrified that she would ad-lib. There were blocks of sound placed before and after her on cameras to make sure she did not ad-lib or did not just keep talking, or that there was something to throw to in the event she did keep talking. And the complete replacement of reality with this alternate version in which you are the victim rather than, you know, the dropped fire hose, when in fact she is the dropped fire hose. It's astounding. And now she's liberated from all responsibility, and I expect her to provide material for me at least once a week for the podcast. My God, this is wonderful. It's true. It's the best work she's ever done. I know there's not much competition, but it's the best work she's ever done.
Well, as you said in the podcast, you know, she's trying to challenge the mental acuity of Joe Biden. As you said, Lyndon Johnson has better mental acuity. He's been dead for years.
Oh, yes. Then Sage Steele. Yeah, it was she once was in the seconds before we went on when I was doing SportsCenter in New York and she was in Bristol. She was once slamming, abusive towards me in like 30 seconds to air with no idea that her mic might be open. Or that in a show in which the anchors were in different cities, there would be a reason for her mic to be open and the guy in the other city could hear her 30 seconds beforehand because the audio guy wanted to make sure that the two anchors could hear it. This never occurred to her. And she's like slamming me. And then suddenly I just hear faintly in the background, like somebody talking to her, Charlie Brown's teacher talking to her in her ear. And she goes from these terrible things to, Keith, how are you? Again, like everything that happened up to that point in world history did not actually happen and nobody noticed it. I mean, it's just, it's amazing to me that there are people who can get this far in any kind of, well, in life really, without, you know, forgetting where they lived and wandering the earth for the rest of their lives. I mean, it's just outstanding.
It's a question for the ages. And even great, nice guys like Reese Davis make an appearance on World's Worst Person in the World, as you refer to gambling as a risk-free investment.
Well, this was, Reese was often guilty of being far too subtle for his own good. And this one, he was clearly making a joke. The problem is that gamblers, obviously, sometimes are not in control of themselves. I'd say that happens 9 times out of 10 in their lives, but that's another thing altogether. I gambled once and I felt that adrenaline rush go through me and I went, I'm never doing this again because this could be addictive. I'm not doing this again. And I haven't. And also the Vikings beat the spread in the last 3 seconds on a 79-yard touchdown pass from Tommy Kramer that had no purpose other than to deny me my $3. In any event, the thing that he said was, you know, this is the way you have he said it to the ESPN betting shill, whoever she was. He said, you presented this as if it's a foolproof investment, and it's for my money is, and he was mocking her pitching this, her getting behind this. But right. I'm just thinking of some guy in Iowa or somewhere in Bristol, for God's sakes, or in New York, sitting there like this in front of the TV, like, I need a break. I'm down $18 million and I have one bet left. I'm going to bet it all on the next thing that the universe tells me. When God hits me in the head with a golf ball, I'm going to be able to. And he hears Reese Davis saying, this is a surefire investment. And he bets on that. And Reese's joke becomes this guy. Then, of course, he takes hostages. So right. This is the only reason I have Reese and I have always gotten along very well. He's always been great to me. And I think the same. But, you have to just point out, don't, it's like it's the equivalent of playing with fire.
Yeah, the Reese has always spoke very well of you. We'll get to the movies in just a second, but this Norby story, Everyone catching up on Norby Williamson out. And I remember the first time I met Norby, this is May of 2010. I solicited a meeting with him. I went in and my first thing I noticed, I said, oh my God, Fox News blaring. I said, we're not going to get along here. We're not going to be simpatico. But he seems nice enough. It's cordial. And he says to me, well, you know, who is the SportsCenter people you like? I said, well, of course, you know, I grew up watching KO and Danny's like, oh, yeah, I know those guys. Yeah. Kind of gives the old eye roll. And then I said, what advice do you have for me, Norby, as somebody here starting? And he goes, honestly, you have to learn to block and tackle first. He goes, too many people come in here trying to do too much. Just come in and block and tackle. I go, okay, but at what point can I like then go to the next level and like, you know, throw a fade? He said, well, just block and tackle first. Yeah. And one thing I always found amazing was this, all these various iterations, Norby, frankly, your biggest fan, and clearly you don't align politically, but no. For a guy who is telling somebody walking in, hey, block and tackle first, and you are not a guy who's coloring inside the lines. You are always taking chances. I'm amazed how well you guys got along.
I mean, certainly in terms of ESPN, he and I knew where everybody else, where the others' skeletons were all buried. So, you know, that probably contributed to some of it. But the one thing, and I didn't talk to Norby probably for 3 or 4 years, when he was a mid-level executive in charge of talent, and he really used the hammer against everybody there. And I was already in my, I'm going to leave here in a year and a half anyway, so I don't give an F. So we butted head quite a bit, and I didn't talk to him for a long time. And once I left ESPN and we ran into each other on a couple of assignments when I was working sports for NBC and then for Fox, It was clear that everything that he did, and I think this was true, everything that he did at ESPN, and he often was the guy who had to do the terrible things that nobody else would have been willing to do. He did it. It was not personal. It was for the product, and it was for the company, and it was for the shows, and it was for what he saw as the integrity of the shows. And sometimes he was right, and sometimes he was wrong, and sometimes it was at my expense, and sometimes it was to my benefit. But he, you know, knew that place by the end so well that I truly think that there will be a day in the next year where they don't get on the air at all because nobody will know how to put in the final, plug into the final electrical socket. They just won't know. There are lots of reasons for him to have exited, and lots of reasons for him to have wanted to, and lots of reasons for them to have wanted him to. But nobody managed to get that thing working better and more around roadblocks. I mean, a mutual friend of ours, whose name I will leave out of this, was on the verge of rehiring me in 2017, probably to do the 6 p.m. Sports Center as the solo anchor. And I'd actually have to move up to Bristol, Connecticut, or at least for a while. We're all pretty much set on that. And I sort of shut down my political career for the time being because I said, I want to enjoy one last span of my career because I've got a feeling that politics is going to come back and I'm not going to be able to avoid it. I just want a couple of years where people like what I'm doing, and more importantly, I like what I'm doing, and it doesn't wake me up in the middle of the night. And so this was very appealing to me. And then just as we were about to announce it, like within a couple of days, the gentleman who was going to hire me kind of resigned and kind of left in like a puff of smoke, and nobody saw him again. And everything froze solid at ESPN. Nobody moved. There was no president. There were no executives. There was nobody in charge. Everybody was afraid. Everybody was terrified. And particularly, they were terrified about hiring me to do the 6 o'clock show. So the thing went out the window. And what Norby managed to do over the span of the next 2 months was to save what he could out of that and get me a contract first, like to do just freelance stuff here and there, and sort of weasel me back in to the point where I was anchoring the 6 o'clock show like an average of 2 or 3 nights a week for the next 2 years, and doing baseball for them and other things for them in my third full-time go around with ESPN. And mm-hmm. And this was, you know, everything else was frozen solid in the company. He pulled that off, and it was an impressive thing to watch. And I think they will miss him. And I certainly think that what they will miss is the guy who's willing to go and punch the flavor of the week in the nose, metaphorically speaking, and say, this is not going to last, and this is not going to increase our audience. It's merely going to accelerate the descent of our audience, which is what they've got now. And that's an unfortunate thing. But, you know, the next new managers will try to clean up the mistakes of the new managers.
Let's talk movies. Nobody knows network like you do. It's amazing. You had it on the podcast, and I asked you if you ever had it in print form. All the prophecies of network. It's insane. If someone says very casually, oh, they predicted the advent of reality TV, or they predict the way news would go. But for Paddy Chayefsky and Sidney Lumet to do this KO in 1976 is mind-boggling to me. And I remember, I think it was on Counter, you did an episode like you dressed up as Howard Beale. All right. And there was like an article. It was like mad as hell. Keith Olbermann, modern day Howard Beale, angry prophet of the airwaves. That movie, to me, it's just so influential. I can't think of any other film that's more prophetic than Network.
Well, the reason that it's more prophetic than the other ones is that everybody who believed that what it prophesied was going to destroy television news and America, everybody who believed that, those who were fearful of it, they took it to heart and said, this is our warning. This is our equivalent of the book 1984. And the people who wanted to destroy TV news said, cool, I can go on the air and be crazy. And then, you know, the next thing you know, Glenn Beck had his own show. I mean, literally, there's a whole set of prophecies that involve what to do with somebody who's having an emotional breakdown. And in 1976, you know, if you were having an emotional breakdown on television, they took you off the air. Instead of putting you in prime time and giving you more money, which was the thing that happened 20, 30 years later, which was the essence of the plot of the movie Network, that in response, the real story of Network is in response to crisis. In the past, the whole history of media would have been, we have a crisis, we have to resolve this, we have to preserve the integrity of our organization, we have journalism to worry about, we have the health, the mental health of the man in question. And instead, what Chayefsky wrote was, as soon as money was the key ingredient in news, all those things would go flying out the window. And the only thing was, did you see the ratings last night? And that's been the rule ever since. And it's impossible to recreate now the world in which the network newscasts, where they say, oh, we should have newscasts like the way we did in good old days with Walter Cronkite. Two things. One, those newscasts lost their employers $30 to $50 million a year. That was built into the equation. That was the price you paid for having access to the free airwaves that CBS and ABC and NBC had. And then the second half of it was that even in that context, the first thing Walter Cronkite did when he came in every day was to ask about the ratings and to look at the minute by minutes and to say, why didn't we have this story? Look, ABC beat us nationally by 27 viewers. They had 27 viewers more than we did in that segment. They had 38 million, 27 people, and we only had 38 million. I want everybody fired because the ratings have always been part of it. But that first part, which is like the reason that it was different than it is now, was it didn't have to make money. They could just spend as much money as they wanted to. Therefore, they did not have to bribe viewers into watching. They did not have to pretend that news was not news. And the amount of resources that could be devoted, thrown at a single story, is essentially infinity. And that went out the window too. And the reason that Chayefsky saw this in particular was that he was a writer on the show that was a hybrid of news and entertainment at CBS in the 50s called You Are There. And this part of it always kind of gets left out of the network story, that he and the director of the film both had worked on this show. And they would recreate historical events and have... It sounds ludicrous, and in fact, I've seen many of them. They're all great. They would have some actors portraying Julius Caesar, and what do you say, Emperor? Do you really think you should go in there after all these prophecies about the Ides of March? Not a problem. And then they'd show him getting stabbed. But then they'd cut inside, and instead of it being actors, Walter Cronkite would be standing inside the Senate. I've just stabbed Julius Caesar. Bongo Caesar. That's the way it was. March 15th, 27 BC. Walter Cronkite, CBS News. And this was before somebody went, do you think it's a good idea to have the newscasters pretending that they're reporting live from, 2,000 years ago? Does this add to their credibility, or do you think it subtracts from their credibility? And somebody went, hey, you're right. And that's where they divided the line. And Chayefsky was before the line. He saw what would happen if the line was ever erased again. And the day it was erased, which was probably, 10 years after the movie came out, everything that they had in the movie came true. And there's no way to recreate for people who are seeing Network for the first time now how bizarrely that hit, how ludicrous that was. I mean, it was even to those of us who were like just starting in the business and beginning to understand that this was not necessarily the most principled of fields to go into. It was like, well, thank God that'll never happen. And on virtually almost everything I've seen, everything, it's either happened to me that happened in that film, or it's happened to somebody I know, or I've heard a story about it, except the anchorman getting shot from the audience for low ratings. And if you take that as a metaphor, that's only happened to me 6 times. So,
and it's so eminently quotable. Like William Holden says, he's saying life is bullshit and it is. What more do you want from me?
Yeah.
Or later on, him and Faye Dunaway, normally when a man, why is it a woman wants to insult a man, she must impugn his cocksmanship.
Yes.
I stopped comparing genitals in grade school. Like, it's just flowing, that whole movie.
Yeah, I dropped one of them in there about where he said, I've reached this age in life in which death is a tangible thing with definable features. And I changed it up, dropped it into the podcast about a week ago. And one of my regular viewers, who's also an addict, and I'll leave his name out of it. He's a newsman, so I don't want to tar him with my brush. But he sent me a note going, I heard that. He's another Network fan. He said, I heard that. And you understand that the influence of the movie Network on people in television, and particularly television news, those of us above the age of 50, I would say it's probably close to 100%.
1976, the movie came out. Rocky, of course, won Best Picture. And I would argue it should have been Taxi Driver, which you texted me once. You heard a reference You got to tell me, who's the New York weatherman who said, this is Travis Bickle's dream?
What is it? It was a New York newscaster on All News Radio who said that the weather was Travis Bickle's dream, that it was sweeping the streets of all the scum or whatever the line was.
Someday a real rain will come and wash all the scum off the streets, a line from the movie.
And it's like, I looked out the window, I was like, yeah, you know, that's actually, he should do the weather, because that's exactly what it is, because it's not just that it's rain, which would be just that rain is coming in sort of diagonally, horizontally, so it's actually sort of washing the streets. It's exactly right. I was like, and the guy doesn't have a regular shift on the All News radio stations. He bounces back and forth and he fills in. I was like, just leave him on all day. He seems to know what he's talking about. But it's wonderful when you see lines like that or things that get repeated as kind of canon. It's like in baseball, every baseball broadcaster has at some point said that a pitcher has finished with a flourish, which is quoting Vin Scully's line from the last outs of Sandy Koufax's perfect game against the Chicago Cubs in 1965. And, you know, now you'll hear, I got all over my friend Gary Cohen, who does the Mets games, for doing this one day, where like some Met came out of a strong five innings. A starter finished a strong five innings of maybe, you know, 8-hit, 3-run ball, striking out 12. And he said, Eddie finishes with a flourish. And I was like, it's reserved for perfect games. But it's interesting the way the lexicon gets added to and becomes universal in a particular field as network. But
it made me think of like catchphrases and lines. Neil Everett, I told him years ago, I said, I became a fan of yours forever, because on a home run ball, you said he'll take him across the street to Mitch and Murray, which is a reference to Glengarry Glenn Ross. And he said the CP at the time, who you and I both know, pulled him aside and goes, hey, I wouldn't use that. He goes, why not? He goes, well, what is it? He goes, it's a line from a movie called Glengarry Glenn Ross. He goes, no one's going to know what that is. He goes, well, I don't care. I get it.
That's it. Particularly in sports, you're never going to get a sports fan who then calls up and says, I'm never watching you guys again because I didn't get that reference, because I'm a sports fan and I know everything. And it's absolutely true. I mean, I discovered this when I was a kid, and I've told this story on the podcast too, where my dad had me try to defeat the loudmouth at the office, who was the big baseball expert, and everybody was tired of him being a baseball expert. And I was 10 years old, and my dad said, I've told him, you know more about baseball than he does, and this has really pissed him off. And I'm going to call you at home, and I want you to convince him, make up a name, whatever team he's going to ask you to name, the 1947 Yankees or something, make up a name and convince him that the guy really existed. And I'll give you $25. And this is, I'm 10 years old. It's like, this is my lifetime savings being doubled. And I convinced this guy that there was a pitcher named Rick Talbot on the 1939 Yankees. And it was the first time I was ever sworn at by an adult on the phone. It was really, you know, but it's the baseball fans, sports fans, and to some degree, sports interviewers, they're not going to tell you they don't know it. Just do it, and do it for yourself. It makes it more entertaining and more enjoyable, and you feel like you have been true to yourself and paid homage to something that influenced you positively.
Yeah, I love that thought process. For years on Counting, you closed by saying good night and good luck. When the movie came out, of course, I thought of you, the story of Edward R. Murrow. It's directed by George Clooney. Mm-hmm. But I'm really curious. I've never heard you speak publicly what your thoughts were on David Strathairn playing Murrow. Because when I had you previously on Cinephile, we talked baseball movies. You told me how fond you are of Eight Men Out, yep. As am I. You told me that there's some issues with verisimilitude. But as far as the story and John Sayles' writing, it's beautifully made. Strathairn's very good as Eddie Seacott. What did you think of his representation of Murrow?
I'm going home after one countdown show in Secaucus, New Jersey, in a studio that might be somewhat familiar to you because it was then the home of MSNBC, and it is now used by the squatters from MLB and NHL networks.
40 Hearts Way.
That's right. And there is only the high-end stuff has been changed. The sign on the back of the door of the bathroom that tells you who to call in case the John overflows, it's the same sign, and just a number has been taped over in paper. They really invested heavily in the non-essential infrastructure. But I'm leaving to get in the car to come back to Manhattan at, you know, 9:02 p.m. one night in 2006 or 7 or whenever it was, and somebody's coming in for a live interview on the 9 o'clock show, and it's him. It's David Strathairn. And I said, hi, I'm Keith. I may be the only person who appreciated your work as Eddie Seacott and Eddie Murrow. And he got a great laugh out of him, and they were rushing him in to get him on the air. I forget who he was going on with. I mean, we had 25 different shows on after me at 9 o'clock on MSNBC. So I don't know where he was going, but I got to meet him once and tell him I thought he was superb in it. And of course, he's a good, superb and extraordinarily broad-ranged actor. And to pull off Seacott, this kind of sour, certainly unprincipled guy who then tries to get away with it and it wasn't really my fault. I mean, Joe Jackson gets a lot of the blame for the 1919 World Series. Eddie Seacott was the guy who made it happen. I mean, he really was the guy who on the field made it happen and then tried to sort of avoid responsibility for it. And he delivered that wonderfully. And then as Murrow, there was just enough of the mannerisms and the speaking style. He got the cadence exactly right. And very few people have tried to do Murrow. And there's a reason for it. You know, it's just you cannot do a good enough impression to capture the style and not look like parody, and the person you wind up parodying is yourself. But he managed to do it. And I mean, again, not that there's huge competition for it, but Daniel J. Travanti did it once in a TV version of it with Dabney Coleman as William S. Paley, which was far worse casting. But it was I thought he did marvelously at it. And I thought that was a well-timed film that addressed a topic that, you know, gets more increasingly important with every passing day.
You and Lauren Bacall, what do you got?
Well, if you've ever wondered whether the universe has a macabre sense of humor, this is the story of Lauren Bacall. Every male can point to some public female who enters their life at some early stage. And I don't want to say prepubescence, because if it was prepubescence, this wouldn't be an issue. But at some point, 11, 12, 13, depending on an individual's personal development, some friends of mine, 7 or 8, you realize that little girls are different than little boys, but particularly big girls are different than little boys. And that's usually some kind of public figure. And I don't remember if it was Key Largo or To Have and Have Not. Right. Where I saw Lauren Bacall on my little black and white TV when I was, I don't know, 11 years old or whatever.
She's 18. Bogart's 43 at the time.
I'm sitting there probably playing with a truck on the floor or my baseball cards. And I just look up and do this. Lauren Bacall. And so anytime thereafter that I saw Lauren Bacall, it was that same kind of reaction, because of course it's now weighted with the idea that was one of those people who contributed to my understanding of the difference between the genders in a very practical way. Now, flash forward to like 2007, and I am buttonholed in the office at MS by Lawrence O'Donnell, who was then just on the periphery, and I don't even know what he was. I don't know why they let him in. I don't know why they let him in a broader sense to MSNBC, but he was working as a contributor, and we'd see him once a month or maybe once a year if we were lucky. And then Lawrence comes in and goes, "I have to talk to you. I have to talk. If you just see Lauren Bacall coming down the street, go to the other side of the street." I was like, "Well, she's like 85. What sort of?" I mean, if she hit me, what would happen? No, it's not like that at all. I said, well, why do I have to avoid Lauren Bacall? She's madly in love with you. And I was like, what? And he said, I was seated next to her at a party the other day. And she said, I know you. You work at MSNBC. Tell me, what is Keith really like? And he said she never stopped. It's like 2 hours, never stopped talking about you. And I was thinking about the cosmic mismatch here. It's like, you know, zoom, missed her by 40 years. It's the thought that counts, universe, I suppose. But then there was somebody came in within days and went, did you see the article? And I went, what article? Lauren Bacall. And I'm like, oh God, what now? And there it was, a lovely little comment in which she explained that she, all other newscasters could go to hell. She just listened to me. And she's, I'm a Keith Olbermann girl. And I was like, well, it's second place, but but I guess.
But I'm behind Humphrey Bogart.
All right. And then, of course, then the punchline of all punchlines is shortly thereafter, I started living with Katie Turr. And Katie Turr was working at Channel 11 in New York, and she came home and she said, "You'll never guess who's working for us and is a huge fan of yours. And I'd love to love you to meet him." I said, "Oh, who's that?" "Humphrey Bogart's son." So, of course, Lauren Bacall's son, Stephen, who was a news writer. And eventually he was looking for something else and he came to work for me. So wow. After this whole thing with Lauren Bacall, who Stephen and Lauren had a kind of tense relationship, as most mothers do with their sons. After that, I'm looking out of my newsroom, and every once in a while, let me take the glasses off so I can do this correctly. Every once in a while, I see some guy writing. I just look out into the bullpen of the writers and I see this. This Bogart. Say, who's the guy doing the impression of Humphrey Bogart? Oh, right, his son. So Steve worked for me for a while, just a great guy. And then he left the business because he burned out. He's running his father's estate. And all the Bogart hats you're actually buying from Steve Bogart. But the whole thing was like, it sounds like a bad Letterman brush with greatness story. It's like how I did not date Lauren Bacall. So there it is.
Timing is everything. I knew this story would hit. Let's close with this. Curb Your Enthusiasm just wrapped up yesterday. Larry David is one of the voices in your podcast. Has a great Bob Shepard impression. As you said recently in the pod, you've had dinner with Larry. You're not particularly close. We've had a few meals. He's a great guy. He's, as you said, not what is on the show, an extension of that, but very kind and generous. But I thought your tribute to Richard Lewis was amazing, man. It was so heartfelt and so generous and so genuine. And seeing Richard last night, I couldn't help but think of you. And the first time I had Lewis on the podcast, I brought you up. I said, how did you connect with Keith? And he goes, "I just thought he was the funniest guy." And he goes, "I was at a Lakers game." And I said, "You're like Groucho Marx with that mustache and all those one-liners." And he goes, "We became friends." And your tribute to him was incredible. It was such a genuine bond that you two shared.
I'm still not close to processing it. It's still every once in a while I will think, I've got to text the prince about this, or I've got to find out how his dog is doing. And I mean, he and I were declared each other brothers, and obviously, as I said in the farewell to him, the brotherhood of Larry David and Richard Lewis is far older and far deeper than the brotherhood of Keith Olbermann and Richard Lewis. And it was and Richard was the kind of guy who had, there were probably 300 of us who were his brother, which is what you want to have in life. But he was all the things, we're talking about the debate about who's the real Larry David, who's the real Richard Lewis. Resembled almost nothing of the public persona. Not that the public persona was insincere in any way or not drawn from life, because he was all constantly working out his neuroses, and particularly the height of his stand-up stuff in the 80s and 90s was really him and a way to work it out. And he was OCD and he was compulsive and he did have a script, essentially script notes the size of a roadmap of the United States of America that he would unfold on stage and go in this direction or go in that direction. Today we're going to Waterloo, Iowa, and tomorrow we're going to San Francisco. And it depended on how he felt. He was a very complicated guy, but in person, I once had a scare in which I had to cancel a trip that was going to involve lunch with him in Los Angeles. And instead of it being a heart attack, which is what my doctor thought it might have been, turned out I had somehow walked into something in the middle of the night and bruised my chest and created the same sort of pain that would be accompanying that. And so I had, it wasn't a heart attack. You have a bruise. You have a contusion. We want to call it in big medical terms. You have a minor contusion. Just rest for a little while because it's just perfectly placed to hurt for a little bit. So I called Richard from where I was staying with my folks because it was easier to get to the airport from there. And first off, he had immediate advice about what not to tell the press or my employers. No, don't mention the heart. They'll never insure you again. First thing he said was that. And then I spent like a week and I was like, okay, we got a week off. I'm just going to stay here and go to the municipal pool with my father or something like that. And he called every day just to make sure I was okay. And I was like, I swear to you, it's a bruise. This is not a cover story. It was not a heart attack. It was not any kind of cardiac episode. It wasn't even indigestion. It was a bruise. I know. And I just want to make sure that you're very important to men. I just want you to, and I, I don't want to get maudlin. And on every day he called. And, yeah. At some point you're thinking, boy, this is annoying. And then you're like, no, it's love. He was a very loving guy. And, I'm still not even close to being over. Not even close.
Yeah. I don't know how you got through the O, but I could hear the emotion in your voice. And it was like, It was just so genuine, so sincere. And I loved, even like on a professional level, you were like, his stand-up, it's up there with Carlin all time. Like, absolute brilliance, what Richard Lewis is able to do.
Absolutely. And the joy I had of being the straight man for him on, I don't know how many times he was on the MSNBC show. He was on the ESPN2 show.
Yep.
He came on to Current TV with me, which is like, my God, you really are a friend. And you know, we did a live performance. I did a live 2-hour show with Richard Lewis at the 92nd Street Y. He was asked to be, you know, interviewed, and he said, "I'll only do if it's Keith." Yeah. And I made sure, and the recording still exists, and I think this line is still there. I said, "I'll do it on one condition. I get to go out first. And then I introduce you, you'll get a bigger applause that way. But I want to go out because I need to tell the audience something first, not with you not there." And he thought I was going to embarrass him. So he said, "No, don't worry, you'll be fine." And we go out there, and or I go out there and I say, "Well, I just wanted to express how great a guy and a good friend this man has been to me in the variety of circumstances, blah, 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 blah." All true. None of it exaggerated. None of it rushed. And I said, "Besides which, I wanted to at least finish one sentence tonight." And with that, ladies and gentlemen, Richard Lewis. And he came out, and the look on his face was, "You got me. You really got me." It was like, son of a, very, very, very De Niro like, and with the pointing of the finger, you got me a little. And that was him, because my job with him always was just to go, "And..." Or, "But doesn't that contradict?" "No, of course it doesn't contradict. What are you crying about? I don't really mind." And to have that to be that close to brilliance, and, you know, sort of this sparkler going for 2 hours without interruption, or in the shorter formats on the TV shows, just a priceless memory and exhilarating, and also not a great deal of work. And he did all the lifting on those performances. And it was just like, every once in a while, while I was off camera, I'd look like I'd do this to him, which was like, "We only 30 seconds and then the network goes away from us. So wrap it up." That was my other job with him. But what a brilliant man, and what a lovely, lovely friend. What a dear friend.
You mentioned when he was on ESPN, Darren DiMatteo apparently has an epic voicemail from Lewis, which he's trying to recover. I don't know if it's still available, but I said it was just Richard Lewis unhinged, because it was so brilliant and so funny.
Apologizing to Darren, who was the guest booker on the Olbermann show on ESPN2, because he had to make a change in plans at the last minute. Right. And right. I mean, you know, just we had one at MSNBC where they wouldn't let him on. He was doing the original MSNBC show in 1997, and they would not let him on to the Burbank facility to get to the studio. So he of course drove himself, and he was there an hour beforehand, and I start getting phone calls from him, and they won't let him in. He's going to another gate. We've got another pass. We've sent out a bureau producer to come get him. We don't know. She's apparently resigned, left the country. On and on this goes. And finally I just said, "Richard, I'm just going to, you mind just keep calling in wherever you are. We'll put you on every time." And we put him on the phone. It's like, Richard Lewis still trying to get into the studio. And it finally he arrived, and it was like the Monty Python with the no one expects the Spanish Inquisition at the end of that episode. He finally gets in, and you see him sitting him in and sit him down. And I finally made it. I went, "Great. It's 8:59. That's tonight's edition of The Big Show. The news with Brian Williams is next." And you see him going, I said, "I don't have any more time. What do you want me to do? Postpone Brian Williams?" I was wanted to say, "You know what would happen if we did that? Wait, you'll find out in about 8 years what happens if you cross Brian Williams." And so the Richard made, we made a just a bit ad lib, because they wouldn't let him into the studio that one night. It's just anything that happened, like Larry David, anything that happened, find that humor in it, extract it, and run with it. Marvelous, brilliant talent, brilliantly
done. What a beauty. Countdown with Keith Olbermann, Tuesdays, Wednesdays, Thursdays, Fridays. Make sure you listen to it as I do. Make sure you watch it on YouTube. The numbers are growing. Obviously, in a political year, it is vital content from KO. And by the way, if you want the political stuff, we still talk baseball in the pod. You still do things I promise not to tell on your favorite topic, me. So there's lots of great levity there along the way. And it's a great podcast. And obviously, I encourage everyone to listen to it, because we need you now more than ever. And by the way, for all those dog lovers out there, what you're doing again for dogs. It's I think I went to him and said to you, I said, baseball lover, movie lover, you go, no, I didn't. Dogs number one. Yeah. You found your calling late in life, but now you've found it. So
yes, life and late in life's pageant, though it may be, I finally found my way towards dogs. And they have patiently, my three major dogs are sitting over on the couch, having been very quiet, very patient for this recording, which is very much unlike them. So I have to reward them with a W-A-L-K, I think, immediately.
I love it. KO, you're the best. Thank you so much for this. I really appreciate it.
Pleasure, Adnan.
Thanks once again to Keith Olbermann. He was fantastic as always. I do look forward to taking a tour of his museum at some point. He's a fanatical baseball fan. He loves baseball history. So at his place, apparently he's got like just stuff like Bill Buckner's glove, like Hannes Wagner card. So I told him I got to get out there at some point. Eduardo Perez, I'm very jealous, has taken the tour, but he's also got a bunch of dogs too. So you get what you get. Like, you're going to have to go there. I'm like, all right, I want to go see Keith Hernandez's jockstrap, but I may get bit by a dog. That's what I'm looking at potentially, but maybe I should really have a dinner set up with KO just so I can tell stories just like I did with the Bob Costas dinner. Once again, thanks to Keith. Make sure you check out his podcast. A couple things here before we get to Crumb. I really want to say when it comes to Curb, as far as the greatest hits, I neglected to mention, if there's a favorite episode, I think Palestinian Chicken is as good as it gets. I mean, that episode is hysterical, and now obviously very timely considering what's happening in the Middle East, but just the fact it was so fearless and so funny is great. Early on, the episode of The Beloved Aunt, when there's a typo, that's a great one. Porno Gill with Bob Odenkirk, fantastic. Do you have a favorite episode, Cody, or a favorite bit that you enjoy?
Let me think about that for a second.
Circle back with me after we get this done. We couldn't really find any negative blurbs, by the way. Alan Sepinwall, the only one that Chris could find of Rolling Stone. I love Sepinwall, by the way, a huge Sopranos guy, wrote the book on the Sopranos. He said of Curb, I laughed at least a couple of times at almost every new episode, but those laughs often came after long, uncomfortable stretches where none of the material in between landed. Ouch. And Nick Shager of the Daily Beast, whether it's Larry concocting a dream scheme or repeatedly employing the I like it gambit, the show continues to mire its morons in choice nonsense. It's good wordplay. Very good with the alliteration. Speaking of morons, he was anything but. I want to talk about Crumb. This is a documentary that, again, like so many movies.
I got my episode.
Yeah,
crazy, go ahead. Crazy Eyes Killer.
No, oh, yeah, that's a great one, especially when he does the rap. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, nut in your eye. I remember that was the punchline. And then Larry's like, oh, I like how you. And then the whole, are you my Caucasian? Yeah. Yeah. Crazy Eyes Killer. That's got to be in the top five. That's very, very strong. Good call by you. I think everything with Leon, by the way, is just great, too. Like, what I thought, because he wasn't a character that came from the beginning, but I thought Leon took it to a different level. That whole arc with the blacks and Vivica Fox, fantastic.
Also, the doll episode when the kid gets upset about
the doll in his pants is just unbelievable. All right, let's get to Crumb, a film by Terry Zwigoff. For those who don't know what it's about, filmmaker Terry Zwigoff creates a complex but affectionate portrait of his longtime friend, underground cartoonist Robert Crumb, a notorious curmudgeon who would prefer to be alone with his fellow cartoonist wife, Aline Kaminsky Crumb, and his beloved vintage jazz records. Crumb reveals himself to be a complicated personality who suffered a troubled upbringing and harbors a philosophical opposition to the 1960s hippie underground that first celebrated his work. Listen, I just think it's a flat-out brilliant movie. Like I said, it's my favorite documentary of all time. The people who, of course, championed it, who else? Siskel and Ebert. When the movie came out, they both said this is an absolute work of art and it's absolute genius because it's so intimate in showing a controversial personality and his traumatized family. And whenever people ask me, you know, what is it you love about movies? It's the feeling of being in someone else's shoes. As Roger Ebert famously said, it's a machine for generating empathy. You know, to me, this is the quintessential movie that I've ever seen about the importance of art. You know, what can art do for someone? The next time someone says, well, who cares about movies? What do they matter? Well, in the case of Crumb, this guy overcame such a dysfunctional family. There's so much stuff that he had to overcome, but he found his way. He found his calling through being a cartoonist. And that was how he was able to find his way. And I can't think of anything more inspiring than this movie. And by the way, it's really funny. I mean, it's bizarre as hell. He's into weird sex. He likes piggybacks. He's got a brother who says he masturbates 7 times a day. Like, there's just weird stuff all over the place. I remember when they were marketing Crumb, they're like, what is this movie? It's about the cartoonist who just like talks about weird stuff. I'm like, pretty much. But it's a movie that you'll never be forgotten. It was filmed for over a period of 6 years. And during his years-long money-starved struggle to make this documentary, director Terry Zwigoff was laid up in bed with crippling back pain and was suicidally depressed. At one point, he encountered Terry Gilliam, who he knew had worked with Crumb in the late 60s. Approaching Gilliam, Zwigoff asked for some help with the budget. Gilliam, who people may know, of course, from Monty Python, Fisher King, the rest of it, reached into his pocket, handed over a nickel, and then walked away. I want to let that sit in for a second. Imagine I saw you go, Cody, I'm working on a movie. I need some help with the finances. You reach in your pocket, hand me a nickel, and walk away. I'm like, you know what? Gee, thanks. Now mom can get that operation. Can't believe Terry Gilliam did that. Media reports following the film said that Robert Crumb later told Jerry Zwigoff he hated the film. According to Zwigoff, however, this never happened. The two still speak on a regular basis. The late Gene Siskel considered it the best film of 1995. According to Robert Crumb, after his brother Charles committed suicide, the first thing his mother said to him was, "How could he do this to me?" That's the mom from hell. On a dark note, prior to the film's release, Robert Crumb's brother Charles did indeed commit suicide. Robert Crumb and his group called R. Crumb and his Cheap Suit Serenaders can be heard playing My Gal Sal during the art gallery scene at 2755. A brief shot of one of Crumb's drawings depicting a girl performing fellatio on her father was probably the reason why the film was given an 18 certificate in the UK. Picked by Entertainment Weekly as one of the 50 greatest independent films. That was back in November of 1997. The film is included on Roger Ebert's Great Movies list. Ebert himself called it the second best film of 1995. And it's available, by the way, on Criterion. The Crumb family did not only have three children, as the brothers had two younger sisters whom the filmmakers approached to appear in the movie. They not only refused, but threatened to file a lawsuit against Robert and his producers unless he paid them reparations for his crimes against women. They were ignored. No legal action was taken. Crumb is a movie that rewards deep, deep viewing. The more I've seen it, the more I've enjoyed it, but amused by it. And like I said, genuinely moved by it and the power of what art can do. Roger Ebert himself, the Chicago Sun-Times, once said, "One of the most remarkable and haunting documentaries ever made, Manola Dargis, Why Love of Spin, by turns hilarious and grim." And lastly, of Michael Schrago of New Yorker, "The movie isn't a testimonial or a Valentine. It's unpredictable and galvanizing. An empathetic portrait of the artist that also unveils a trenchant view of American families' dashed illusions." Seriously, I cannot recommend Crumb enough. And of course, all roads lead to Paul Giamatti. In American Splendor, Giamatti's playing who? Harvey Pekar, the cartoonist, who befriends Harvey Pekar early in his life, but R. Crumb. And Crumb, I don't know who plays him in American Splendor, but I remember seeing American Splendor after the moment thinking, oh my God, that's Crumb. He's also just as strange as Harvey Pekar. But if you like cartoonists and if you like that world, you know that Crumb is a name that you cannot be messed with. And his family and his life story is nothing short of inspiring and also very, very funny. Go to Apple Podcasts. Please subscribe, rate, and review. Let us know what you think. Thanks once again to KO for coming on. Thanks to Chris Cody for all of his hard work. We'll continue next week. I don't know what the hell we're going to do. Curb Your Enthusiasm's done. Maybe Monkey Man. Dave Patel's new movie looks pretty good. Maybe Ghostbusters. Take the kids to go see that. We'll figure it out. You know your spot is Cinephile. I'll see you at the movies.